That's Kenny Loggins and Footloose from the film. I can't remember. What's the film called, Mark?
I don't know. Is it in the title? I can't remember.
I'm not sure.
We'll look it up.
It might be Footloose. Anyway, welcome to Mark. It's Friday. It must be movie day.
Excellent. Excellent.
It's all good, isn't it? Sun shining.
Yes.
Movies.
Yes.
It's all good. Now, first up, I better get a bit closer to the mic. Mike Leigh's new film, so tell us a bit about that, Peterloo.
This is the true story of the 1819 Peterloo Massacre, where British forces attacked a peaceful pro-democracy rally in Manchester. I have to say, I didn't really know anything about this at all, so it's interesting that obviously Mike Leigh brings this about. There is a sketch by comedian Eddie Izzard where he walks, he basically does this thing talking about British upper class men walking into rooms and they go, "Oh, sorry, were you in here? Oh, yes, I was sat here. Well, oh, okay, yes, no, sorry, oh, sorry, okay." I mean, I can't do it justice. This is the thing, you know.
Eddie Izzard's doing politics, who knew?
Well, exactly, this is the thing. And, you know, it's a 30-second sketch and it is very funny. Look it up on YouTube. The reason I bring that up is because basically, 90% of Peterloo is that sketch. It is people, it is men in rooms discussing revolting against the government and getting better rights. Now, obviously, the idea behind that and the story is a very important one, but how many times can you sit through the same meeting time and again in a movie where it's just people talking? We're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to, okay, yeah, right, fine, we've got it the first time, but then it continues and it gets very boring and, you know, it tests the patience of even the most patient of people, I have to say. Also, the dialogue is either woefully below par or so over the top that you have no idea what actually, you know, what feels real. That's the thing. And it does feel real because we have real accents on here on screen, and it's good to hear some Yorkshire accents done the way that they should be.
I love an accent.
Yeah. So we've got North and South Yorkshire accents. We've also got some Mancunians here as well. And it is good to hear the accents done in film the way that obviously the people speak there. The problem is that some of them are quite hard-edged, so they're very difficult at times to follow. But there's some fun in the accents as well. But, you know, it veers between both of them very, very rapidly. The pro-democracy rally is headed by one of the most powerful and well-known orators. He's a guy called Henry Hunt, who actually lived. He was a real person as well. I found his story quite interesting, actually.
Okay.
He tries to rouse the lower classes by doing all of these speeches and going on these rallies and making his voice heard. He's also got to fight off leadership battles as well from others who see themselves on the same level as Hunt, yet actually they're lower class as well. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on with that character. He's even got problems with the North, even though he's trying to rouse them. Because there's a moment where he says, "I don't wish to stay in Manchester for more than one day," and then he ends up being there for a week.
We can't blame the guy. Well, we've both been there.
Well, you said it, not me.
I actually love Manchester. So,
but this is the thing: is that there are some comedic moments in the film, and I think that's the problem with the film: is that it works when it's being funny. I think this film should have been a surrealist comedy telling a real story. Instead, it's a drama, and you know it tries to talk about important messages and the bloody massacre. But I think the dramatic version that we get here has the wrong tone, basically. So, you know, the film is about North-South divide and about government that created this North-South divide as well. None of that is looked at in great depth. It is, as I said, people in rooms talking about things and never actually doing things. And, you know, there's a lot of bravado, there's a lot of hot wind going on when they're talking. So I just found it, and this is 2.5 hours, let's not forget, I found it boring.
So where do you think Mike Leigh's going? Obviously, you know, Mancunians, lovely, honest people, but where is he actually going with this, do you think, as a director? Is it his idea of doing politics at this kind of time, or?
I think so. I think it is a movie which clearly he decided now is the right time to do it. And I take nothing away from the fact that they put this out there, because, you know, a lot of people won't know about this. I didn't know about it.
I don't. I mean, you know, I've been to Manchester many, many times, and Liverpool and the surrounding areas, but history is not my strong point, right? I never knew about that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. So, you know, bringing these types of historical events that a lot of people don't know about is very good. You know, it gives us more history to talk about. I just think that he's got the wrong tone with it. You know, Mike Leigh's earlier work, I mean, I love Secrets and Lies. I think it's a great, great film. You know, you compare Secrets and Lies to something like Peterloo, and while this is much more, I don't want to say epic, but it's wider, it feels like it's lost that human touch, whereas Secrets and Lies was very human. It was very down to earth. It was very raw. It was very gritty. And Mike Leigh is good at talking about lower classes.
Well, yeah, that was what he was known for.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's what he's made his name for. And I think what he's trying to do here is do the same thing, but it just feels like a real drag.
Yeah, it's a shame because, such a great guy. And
Yeah,
that's a shame. Okay, we're going to do Netflix, the other side of the world. I love Netflix because of what they're doing, and I know we've touched on it before, and The Other Side of the Wind.
Yeah, so this is a story of a Hollywood director who emerges from semi-exile with plans to complete work on an innovative motion picture. Now, I'm going to give you some behind-the-scenes story on this first, actually. So, Orson Welles, who is in? Who made this film? When he was trying to make this in 1970, he was on the outside of Hollywood. People didn't want him at all, so he was pinning his hopes on The Other Side of the Wind, getting him back into the A-list of Hollywood. He began filming in 1970. Filming was on and off until 1976.
Wow!
There were problems with financing. There were problems with on-location filming as well. Eventually, Orson Welles just abandoned the project, even though he'd filmed 10 hours of footage. Then Welles died, and many companies since have tried to complete it. Normally, funding or legal obstacles have prevented it. Then in 2016, Netflix announced that they'd secured funding for it, and they'd got the 10 hours of tapes to finally edit the film together and release it. So, some 42 years after they started filming, we now have a complete version of The Other Side of the Wind.
That's a great story, I've got to be honest.
It's incredible.
As a film fan, which I know you are as well, obviously, but I can see that.
And let me say, I've condensed that story as well. That's the thing. There was so much more going on with it. So what I will say about The Other Side of the Wind is it's a tough film to get into. There's no easy entry point. It roughly takes about 45 minutes before we get a cohesive narrative that settles down into a plot. And even then, it's difficult to watch. So we have a film within a film, basically, here. So we have the Hollywood director, played very gruffly by John Huston. And he is he's throwing this party for his friends to watch this film that he has made, The Other Side of the Wind. And he's sat there and there's scenes missing and there's dialogue missing as well, and he's leaning in and he's trying to understand what he needs to make sure that this is an impressive film, and all of this is done in black and white, and it kind of gives it that classic feel, that old style Hollywood, which is great. The film that they're watching, so the film in the film, is color. And it plays like a softcore exploitation flick meets art house.
Okay.
It is essentially a woman running around in very skimpy clothes or nothing at all, trying to woo the latest Hollywood heartthrob. And occasionally, there are glimmers of an interesting plot going on there. But I say occasionally.
Yeah.
It really doesn't happen that much. So, you know, it's a film that you kind of think, well, we've waited 40-something years. What is meant to be sparkling here? What is meant to be wowing us? And I get the idea, the film within a film, it's a really interesting idea. We have seen it done several times before. This one doesn't really work. Hollywood is littered with people trying to get back to being their best. You know, they had a hit, and now they need to get back to the top.
Hitchcock was a prime example, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, there's very few who stay at the top constantly. And, you know, this is a meta film about trying to get back to the top because it's self-referencing itself all the time as well. So I kind of found it frustrating a lot of the time. I applaud its ingenuity of putting a film together. I just don't think it works as a narrative film. However, when I was saying about the backstory, and you were saying that was fascinating, Netflix have commissioned a documentary about the backstory. It's called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. And I've got to say, that's come out as well today on Netflix. That is much more interesting than The Other Side of the Wind. Now, I implored the idea of finally getting this lost Hollywood movie onto screens. But at the same time, I sometimes think, maybe we don't want that. Maybe we want to leave it, you know, in the wilderness, in the wild, in the wind, so to speak, because sometimes it just doesn't hang together well.
Yeah, it's all about timing, as you know, as
it
well.
It is, absolutely, so. Absolutely.
Toy Story. I've just been tested, Mark, on another film thing. We've gone mad on film, but we don't want to go off topic because we've got to talk about DVDs. The first purge for those who've not had enough of Halloween.
Yes, well, this is the story of America's third political party, the new founding fathers of America. They come to power and conduct an experiment. No laws for 12 hours on New York's Staten Island. Now, nobody has to stay, but those that do will be rewarded with $5,000.
Is that all?
It's not a lot, is it? When you think about they've got to survive for 12 hours. It's not a lot. The Purge franchise, I've always found it a bit hit and miss. The first film I thought was kind of a standard home invasion movie. Then they took it to the streets. I thought some elements worked outside, others didn't. With the first Purge, and it's a prequel, I must say that. It's still on the streets more than in the home, but it is... It's more a political movie. I think that's the thing. This idea that there's no laws for 12 hours is quite a frightening one because it invokes fear, not only in the people who are obviously in the film, but also you're sat there and you're thinking, at some point, this really could become reality. And I think that's the scary thing, is because the way that the film plays it is you're like, well, this is so close to reality, it's quite frightening. Also, the good thing about this film, actually, I really like this about it, is the reaction to everything that is happening politically in the US at the moment. So, you know, this is a movie about lower classes and especially black people who've become the hunted in the film. You know, the white people are in power and they set this purge as a social experiment. But there's something deeper. There is a huge underlying current in this movie about race. And I think that's the thing. So it is very brutal viewing in that regard. The plot actually revolves around several different factions of this neighborhood in Staten Island. So there's a lot who are religious. They pray to God and they hope that he will help them when they're all locked in a church overnight. There's the opposite of that. The ones who are going to stand their ground. You know, they've lived on Staten Island for years. We're not going to be moved. And if it means coming down to a fight, that's what it's going to do. Then there is this new set of gangsters who feel like the streets belong to us. And, you know, they're doing it for very different reasons. They're reasons that actually quite surprised me. I think the storyline that's the most interesting, because it throws up several different themes, that is this one about gangsters. How, you know, in a lot of films, they are seen as you know, the scourge and everything else like that. In this one, it takes a very different turn, and I was quite surprised by it. The funny thing about the Purge franchise is that it started as a horror film, and now it's flipped to an action series, and it's also got a lot of politics going into it as well. So I think the franchise as it is at the moment can't continue in that vein because, you know, I think it won't last with politics having its beating heart there. But the Purge, the first Purge, is certainly one that I think is the most well done, and it keeps its narrative and it keeps its eye on the game all the way through to make a really interesting film. It's tough, it's brutal, it's quite rough as well. It also is holding up a mirror to the entire country, showing what is, you know, what is happening now. So I think it's very interesting to see an action movie, because it is action more than horror, I will say that, that is so in tune with modern society. Because normally it's, you know, running, jumping, gunning, and whatever else. Yeah. This one is actually a lot more political, and I think a lot of people will give it credit to. So I think the first Purge is a very good example of how you can combine action, but also give a very deep meaning to some of the politics that's going on.
Okay, so that's the first Purge out this week on DVD. The other one, Sicario 2, the sequel to the first one, which I actually loved.
Emily Blunt, wasn't it?
Emily Blunt, yes. So Sicario 2, Soldado, or Day of the Soldado, depending on where you are in the world. So with the human trafficking across the US-Mexico border now at a premium and run by the cartels, it's left to federal agent Matt Graver and Sicario.
I was just going to ask that. Is he still in it?
And Sicario Alejandro to fight the war on terror. You know, I think you're going to, well, you've already said this anyway, is that Sicario, for me, best film of 2015.
Yeah, I would have gone.
You know, one of the best dramas of past years as well. I mean, that bridge sequence, I think I forgot to breathe. It was so intense. It really was.
I'm probably going to have to give that another watch, actually. I can't believe that was 3 years ago.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible, isn't
scary.
It? So with Sicario 2, the intensity is still there, like the first one. But whereas the first one was very, it was like rapid fire. It was occasionally, and it was so brutal and so pulverizing. This one is a slow burn. There's this growing sense of foreboding as to what these characters actually taking on. So the idea is to root out these drug traffickers and these people who are trafficking people across the border. So what they do is the US government decide to kidnap one of the cartel's daughters, but stage it like it was one of the other cartels to escalate a war between the two cartels. So basically they'll take each other out. Very clever idea. It is an incredibly tense scene when they take the daughter. You know, it's right up there with that bridge sequence in the first film as well. Then we have problems later on when Matt and Alejandro have to get separated. And Alejandro takes the daughter back to her mother, but it means wandering across the Mexican plains and the Texas desert as well. And what we find here is, we didn't get this in the first film, we get a backstory of Alejandro. You know, in the first film, he was this cold killer.
Yeah.
We knew nothing about him. In this one, we get a backstory as to why he's like that. And it is a fascinating story. I will say that, you know, it constantly hangs in the air through everything he does. It's there at the back of your mind thinking, okay, is it going to happen now? You know, so you've got that scary attitude. And he's on this road trip, which is a very tough trek across these deserts. And it culminates in a finale that I guarantee, I mean, when I saw it, my mouth was dropped open. I was like, what?
Funny enough, I was talking about this yesterday with a friend of mine. She actually spelt it wrong, but I kind of figured out what film she was talking about.
So. Obviously, you were talking, you were asking about Matt Graver, played by Josh Brolin. Yes, he's here. He's forced to do things he wouldn't normally do. You know, this is a man who likes to get dirty. He says, I'd like to get dirty. But when he's told no, he's not sure what to do because he's not used to hearing that word because he operates outside he operates in a very grey area, shall we say. So, you know, whereas the first film was a very self-contained story, this is a much wider story. It's much more expansive. It includes the Secretary of Defense. It includes the President of the United States. And so, you know, that's, I think this takes this into a wider territory, I want to say that it's written by Taylor Sheridan, who wrote the first film as well. It's directed by Stefan Salima, who directed several episodes of the Gomorrah TV show. Now, if you've ever seen that show.
I've not seen it, but
it's fantastic. It really is. You know, I think it's a perfect match, to be honest with you. There is a slower pace to the film than the first one, yet it's still got that intensity, that slow burning intensity. You're going to be on the edge of your seat. I mean, it's not afraid of changing the narrative either. That's what Taylor Sheridan does a lot in his films. And it's unafraid, once again, of making us feel afraid. So, brilliant filmmaking, once again, you know, a second film that we really didn't expect, to be honest.
No, I didn't expect it.
And I think it's a worthy companion piece. I still say it is my favourite action film of the year.
I was just wondering, actually, because the second one's out as well, I'm guessing there is a pack of two for Christmas coming up, is there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But I would hold off from that because Taylor Sheridan has said he sees it as a trilogy.
Oh, right.
So we're going to get a third at some point.
Maybe they'll leave a space in the box.
Well, that would be nice. They've done that occasionally with some of the things. Yeah.
My Bond collection has got a little space in there.
Yes. Yeah.
So who plays him next? Right, there's something else you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, just quickly, we mentioned it the other week. Mandy is out on DVD this week as well. So this is Nicolas Cage going full Rage Cage, but in the... See, this is why I wanted to mention it as well. this is such a strange, a bizarre film, and yet I can't stop thinking about it. It's set in an alternate 1983 where Nicolas Cage's Red Miller sees the love of his life slaughtered by a religious cult. He sets out to hunt down these perpetrators. It owes a lot to David Lynch's work. It's very... You know, it's very mystifying. It sort of throws you all over the place. The first hour is very much this dark story about this religious cult rising to power and taking down anybody who sees them as a worry. And then what happens is the second hour, Nicolas Cage escapes. He builds a huge axe out of... He molds an axe out of metal... And it's this massive axe. And then he's got a chainsaw, which has got the longest, you know, bit on the end I've ever seen as well. So the last 30 minutes is where we get some full-on Rage Cage action.
And I'm guessing they've made that to fill the screen.
Yeah, this is the thing. Honestly, when he first picked it up, everybody who was in the screen and that I saw it just sort of went, yes. Yeah. You know, they were waiting for it. So, you know, it doesn't disappoint. I will say it's very bloodthirsty. It's not for the squeamish at all. But it's also alternate filmmaking. You know, it is not your standard action film. It's not your standard horror film either. Nicolas Cage is gleefully over the top. I mean, more so than we've ever seen him before, I think, in this. So, as I said, if you like David Lynch's work, or if you like work that... is very trippy.
I do like David Lynch, but I like Nicolas Cage. I mean, we've got about another minute and 10 seconds. We can just talk about Nicolas Cage.
We could.
But yeah, it's just, I do like him because he takes risks. I know he has to take risks. He's had some financial issues, but I just like him because he takes risks.
Well, I will say, Mandy is a huge risk because, you know, if somebody told you this story and showed you it, you'd think, why would you even do this film? But fair play to him, because it's very schlocky B-movie grindhouse, but in such a good way that, you know, as I said, I can't stop thinking about it. It's one of those films, and the soundtrack is this rumbling soundtrack. I mean, everything sort of comes together and creates this weird, weird movie that, you know, if you're a fan of it, you're going to absolutely love it. It really is one for the horror fans, I know that, but at the same time, if you're a Rage Cage fan, you're going to love it as well.
Absolutely. Right, so we've got about 20 seconds. What's coming up next week?
Next week, is it too early to talk about Christmas films?
No, why not?
Right, okay. We've got a Christmas film next week. We've got a directorial debut of Paul Dano, who most might know as an actor from Love... I'm trying to think. War and Peace.
There Will Be Blood.
And There Will Be Blood as well, yes. So, yeah, quite a lot next week, actually.